You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Do what I say, and don't scream. I'm not gonna rape you.
Girl is 15 years old. He drags her to a nearby car park, forces her to strip, then, after repeated oral sex, proceeds to rape her twice.
How is she?
Pretty shaken. Her mum's with her. They're both in with Angie now.
How long did the attack last in total?
Over an hour.
When he finished, he helped put my clothes back on me. He said, "What are you gonna do when you get home?" I said, "I'm gonna have a bath." He said, "Yeah, you're gonna wash every trace of me off you." Then he turned around and said, "I just want to kiss and cuddle before I go."
You know, some days, you know, when I just totally block it out, there wasn't a day that went by when I didn't think about it, that I just get upset in school all the time. And my GCSE results and my schoolwork, I could have done so much better than I did, but I didn't, because I just couldn't concentrate. I just wanted to block everything out all the time. I didn't want to think about it, because that was my way of coping with it.
Taking into account the age of the victim, what occurred to her, a young lady stripped of her clothing, her dignity and her innocence, and held prisoner against her will. An awful offence, absolutely awful.
How many more times have I got to tell you it is not my fault?
You started it.
You started it. Will you stop winding me up?
Brilliant. Her fans are going to see that.
No way.
What?
You heard. No way.
What's up with you tonight?
You, that's what.
Scream and I'll kill you.
Oi! What's it all about?
She's my bird!
She's bloody not!
You go telling anyone about this, alright? I said alright. And don't go to the police, or I'll kill you. Understand? Goodbye. Rape you. If you try to run, I'll kill you in one movement.
Two attacks, a mile apart. The offender's description's good for both of us.
Is that personal description, clothing or what?
General description fits both offences.
Any scientific?
Nothing on the first attack. Boyfriend intervened, thank God. With Zoe, it seems he was boxing clever, very forensically aware.
Can I just ask, what's the extent of the attack?
Indecent assault, forced self-masturbation, repeated oral sex, threats to her life if she didn't comply, everything but rape.
Exactly the same MO as the bank holiday attack on Lisa. We've got a problem here.
I was convinced from the outset that one of the same men was responsible from his behaviour pattern with regards to the attacks themselves, the clothing worn, Southend had a problem of a man with a desire to attack young ladies, and my task was to build up a picture of the offender and arrest him as soon as possible before there was a fourth victim.
I worked in a casino, so I'd been at work all night from 9 till about 3:30, and at 3:30 I'd finished work. I'd borrowed some rollerblades from a friend of mine because I'd always wanted to try. And I thought, now's an ideal time to try, and there won't be too many people around, and I can fall flat on my face without anybody seeing. And so I thought, on the way home from work, I'll just give them a try. I had actually taken them with the intention of rollerblading all the way home, but soon realised that wasn't going to happen, so I had to take them off. I was walking along St John's Wood High Street, and I heard someone kicking a bottle right behind me. So I actually turned round at this point to see who it was, because it startled me. And there was a man behind me. But at that time, there were other people around, so I didn't really give it a second thought. So I just carried on. When I'd walked a little way down the road, I thought I would just stop and check. It's not something I would normally do. It occurred to me that perhaps it would be wise just to look. So I stopped and turned round and scanned the whole road just to check whether he was still there and whether he was actually following me. And I couldn't see anybody. It was completely deserted, so I sort of felt a bit relieved and carried on. The next thing I knew was he grabbed me around the neck.
Give us your money. Put it away.
I think there was a point where I suddenly realised what was actually going to happen, and at that point I decided that it would be over quicker if I just went along with everything that he said without making him angry. I thought it would be best just to do as he says. I let myself in, and my husband was asleep because he wasn't working that night, and I sat there for about 15 minutes just sitting there thinking, turning things over in my head.
Oh, you're gorgeous, you are. This is so out of order. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Where did girls let you hide? Had a girl like you, I'd wrap you in cotton wool you'd want for nothing. I ought to go to prison. What do you think I'd get, 10 years? Anyway, prison's not a deterrent, it doesn't take away the feeling. Besides, Richie's mates will never let him go down. Oh my God. I just told you my name.
Emily?
I was thinking, on the one hand, that I was perfectly all right, that I was safe, I was home, it was all over. All I had to do was have a bath, get into bed, and never think about it ever again. It would all be over and done with. And on the other hand, I thought, if I do that, yes, I'll be all right, but then there'll be other women out there who won't be. And from that point of view, I really felt I had no choice, that I had a sort of a duty, if you like, to report it.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome back to Crime Analyst and the Intelligence Cell, and a very special guest who I'm delighted to interview again. Sam, please introduce yourself.
Well, Laura, I'm delighted to be back, and thank you for the invite and for asking me back to discuss matters further, definitely. But my name's Sam Robbins, and I'm an intelligence analyst, crime analyst, and a fellow crime analyst of yours, Laura. We've known each other we were trying to work it out the other day, we think about 25 years. But I've got quite an extensive background in policing and organised crime, and particularly major crime and homicide. And the analysis of that, having spent almost 20 years in Surrey and Sussex undertaking that and working on some fairly high profile investigations, and also a really keen interest in developing analysis as a profession. And I was part of the homicide working group. I was the national lead for analysis for major crime on the homicide working group, which is a police chief's group where issues of importance get discussed and dealt with. And through that group, managed to supply almost 10 years worth of training, so peer-to-peer training for major incident analysts, where we could get together and discuss cases and best practice and just generally enhance the profession as a whole, really, hopefully. There's a little legacy that's been left there.
So all about legacy. Absolutely. Well, I'm really pleased to have you back, Sam. And of course, we can talk for a very long time about different cases and jobs. And we did say that we would talk about the case where we first met. We've gone back down into our case files and revisited a case. Well, a couple of cases, actually. We're going to talk about Operation Monarch, and we're also going to talk about Operation Orb. And these two cases were really what I recall as being the first linked investigative series where analysis was really at the centre of them. Intelligence-led policing, but also the analytical side, played an absolutely pivotal role in identifying very prolific and dangerous perpetrators. And the case Operation Monarch, when we first met, I mean, we go back in time to 1998. And this was a time where analysis was really brand new. So you talk about professionalizing analysis, and I spent a lot of my years also trying to professionalize the work of analysts, and specifically around the prevention lens of not just having run the sexual offences section at New Scotland Yard, SO11, which is where we first met in terms of that's where I was when you and I first met, but also when I ran the homicide prevention unit. And my team were a brand new group of analysts that I handpicked. They had academic backgrounds, and I put them in an intelligence cell with a group of other analysts from the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force. And myself and one of the other higher analysts agreed to mentor them. And it would be a conjoined mentoring so that they got all of his incredible background and knowledge and expertise, but also mine in terms of the behavior. And I've really focused around behavior. Analyzing behavior, the intelligence-led response, but specifically looking at prevention. Once we've identified people, how do we then understand we learn the lessons, the psychological autopsy? And now looking back at Operation Monarch, and the offender that we identified was Richard Baker, there's still a lot of learning for me reflecting on that job, a job that was, it really changed my mindset, my thoughts, but also my career. And I think that we have these defining cases, don't we? And I spent a lot of time actually training detectives using Operation Monarch, the analysis process, because a lot of people were curious about, well, how did you manage to link offences? How could you say before forensics, before DNA, that you believe there was a strong probability it was the work of one person? And I think really Operation Monarch, because he spent so much time with some of the victims, there was so much behaviour, so much language that I was able to understand with my background with forensic and legal psychology. I did my first degree in psychology and sociology, then I specialized in forensic and legal psychology at my master's level. And I did that at the same time I was in the job. And I think those two things, along with being mentored by people, are really important in terms of your professional development. And it's still ongoing now. I still take a lot of interest in my own professional development, hence talking to analysts and reviewing cases and trying to extrapolate the learning so that we identify offenders far earlier. And of course, that's all the work that I've been doing around the campaign for serial domestic abusers and stalkers to be on the same register as sex offenders. And it's my legacy. I'm still working on it now in 2024. And I began it in 2001 at New Scotland Yard, but I'm still working on it. And Richard Baker just again exemplifies why that's so important.
Yeah, so I think your listeners should be in no doubt at all how absolutely groundbreaking your work was in the Homicide Prevention Unit. So obviously your expertise and everything that you've honed is a lot of it is prevent, you know, we're almost coming from two sides of the coin there. You're all about the prevention and looking at the behaviours and preventing it happen. I very sadly am on the analysis and behavioural side when it has happened. So it's then looking for the and what information can we find there, but the two marry up and you use the information from both to, should the absolute worst happen, you then use that to find the offenders. And your work was, I can't emphasize enough how groundbreaking it was and how important it was. So interesting going back and re-looking at these jobs, and you know, there's questions have been pinging in my head you know, as I've gone through them all. The day you stop learning is the day you need to give up, basically. So, you know, it's always about being curious. And I've recently started watching the latest True Detective, which is the one set out on the ice, set in Alaska, with the amazing Jodie Foster, who it really, you know, really resonated. I was watching it last night and it really resonated me that she always says, ask the question, ask the question. And it's like her catchphrase in that show. And, you know, they weren't getting satisfactory answers or things weren't quite fitting into place. And she says, you're asking the wrong questions. So if you ask a question and nothing makes sense, you're asking the wrong question. So you go back and ask other questions.
Exactly. There are lots of questions you can ask, but are you focused on the right things? And that's where experience, there's no substitute for it. So yes, the Homicide Prevention Unit, I have a lot of memories of that time doing this groundbreaking work that a lot of people just weren't ready for. But at the same time, my team were also deployed on various Category A and Category A plus homicide investigations. And one of those is another one where we intersected, which you mentioned Minnie Dowler when we last spoke, Amanda Dowler. But actually, I was asked to support Operation Yedis, which was Amélie Delagrange, who had been hit on the back of the head and was found on Twickenham Green in a fetal position. And she died, sadly. And that sparked it ended up being a linked investigative series. No one really wanted to link it, but I had to keep pressing upon the importance of linking it. And my team and I, we found many other offences we believed the same offender had committed. That's a story for another time. But that case, again, I was doing the hard work of homicide prevention, 15 different portfolios. I had a brilliant team of analysts, intelligence officers, field officers, researchers, police officers, academics, all within an intelligence cell, which made for a very rich environment, she says, somewhat tongue-in-cheek.
Dynamic,
yes, at a time where people weren't really ready to have academics, intelligence officers, analysts, all police officers, all within the same environment, working to a common goal. We were trying to identify high risk factors, looking at different types of violence and offenders who committed prolific violence and homicides, and reverse engineering it to find out what those warning signs were. And we found many across the different groups, but we also had to support Category A and Category A plus investigations. And that was really hard because I ended up working 24/7 trying to meet all of these demands. So again, resources and the challenges that that brought. I had two phones. I always remember my mum getting very frustrated with me because my job phone was always ringing because our responsibility was Pan London. You add in the national side, once you start to become a national, you work on the national side, which I did. I sat on the ACPO Homicide Working Group before it was even a thing in terms of analysts presenting there. And I was always asked to support jobs, but also share all the things we were doing in the Met. But so yes, there's a huge amount of learning still ongoing. And Richard Baker, let's get back into Operation Monarch, because this was a case that, well, it was incredibly concerning, actually, when I think back to it, of the fact that I was first contacted and told that Essex Police had three offences. And would I go down to Essex Police, to their incident room, and look at the offences and give my opinion? And that was an interesting process in and of itself. I was running the sexual offences section. I'd been trained by someone that we both know. She was called Jackie Foster at the time. She was my mentor when I came in when I was still, actually, I hadn't finished my degree, but I went there for a year, worked there. Jackie very much mentored me, was very patient with me, spent a lot of time talking through cases with me. And when I went back to the Met to run that unit, this was one of the series. Well, Essex Police believe they had a series. They had three offences. So I'm going to explain what they were. And I remember vividly going down to the incident room and the senior investigating officer, someone called David Bright, coming up to me and saying, "All right, young lady, what can I do for you?" And I just sort of looked at him somewhat intimidated. But I said to him, "Actually, I was asked to come and spend some time with you, understand the offences and see whether I could help you, given the work that we do in SO11, the sexual offences section." I explained that. And I ended up walking the crime scenes and getting a very good sense of what they had in Essex. And I too formed the opinion that they were most likely linked. And I went back to London to look at potentially, did we have any other offences? So I'm going to explain what they had in Essex. And so initially they had an attack on a 15-year-old schoolgirl, a really horrific offence that was on the 31st of August, 1998, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And she was walking home, and this was in Leon C, and she was grabbed from behind, and she was subjected to a horrific sexual attack. And I'm not going to go into the detail of the exact sexual acts and so forth, but He did spend time talking to her. He gave if-then scenarios. There was something that seemed to be salient across the offences of if you scream or if you do X, then I will do Y. And she, being a 15-year-old, she was grabbed round the neck. And the neck is a very vulnerable point. We know now that anyone who strangles or grabs around the neck, it increases the chance to serious harm and femicide. It is a high risk factor. Well, this individual, this offender who was unknown at the time, grabbed her by the neck and he raped her. And there was a lot of other behavior for me to consider. So the first thing I always do is ask for the statement, read the victim's statement. Then I like to go to the crime scene because a picture paints 1,000 words, but going to the scene paints 1,000,000. And you spend a lot of time there. And you also have to think about the scene of what it would be like at 3 a.m, because it's very different from what it's like at 4 p.m. and who's around and whether there are cameras. I can see you nodding, yeah. Sam, but the scene visit...
I am nodding furiously.
...is important, isn't it? And as is taking a good statement. And oftentimes I found with victims of rape, the officers were not trained to take statements. And it is an expertise, actually, to take statements from rape victims. And obviously now we know that you have to be trauma-informed as well. And there's a lot of myths and stereotypes too, which I'll come back to. But we had a rape on the 31st of August, or Essex did. Then they believed that they had another attack that was linked, which was on September the 12th, 1998. And that was at 9:45, where a 16-year-old girl was in Queensway underpass in Southend. She had had a row with her boyfriend. He had gone ahead of her, and she had then been grabbed from behind by an offender who said, "Scream and I'll kill you." And she did make noise. She did scream, and the boyfriend heard. He returns back to her. He basically says to the offender, "Leave my bird alone." The offender then punches him in the face and says, "Leave Jason Adams alone. Leave Jason Adams alone. He paid me to come after you. Leave Jason Adams alone." And the boyfriend said, "You've got the wrong person." And the offender spends time saying, "Don't tell anyone. Don't go to the police. Do you understand? Don't go to the police. Good boy." Now, some of these phrases came up consistently, which is why I'm sharing them, because language, we both know, is very important. It leaks a lot of things out about offenders and linking offences.
There are so many benefits of microdosing, and all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order, plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST, for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
So this was a near miss. But what was worrying, Sam, you might recall, was that the same night there was another attack. It was at 11 o'clock of a 26-year-old woman. And she was walking home, like I said, at 11 o'clock. She hears footsteps behind her. This is in Westcliff. And she's grabbed from behind around the neck again. And it's a horrific rape. They all are horrific. He forced her to kiss him. He forced intimacy, cuddling. There was a lot of behaviour again within this offence for me to analyse and understand. And I was very concerned, as were Essex Police, David Bright, and I know Alison Bowers came in. She was the principal analyst. I don't recall seeing her in the incident room. I have to say, I do remember Dave Bright. That was, you know, top of my mind.
Yeah, I did as well, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, I left feeling that they were accurate, that they did have a prolific serial rapist. And when you have two offences in one night, one was a near miss, a bungled attempt, but yet that didn't deter him. That told me this was somebody who was prolific, that he most likely, well, it tells me he's committed, that he wasn't put off, and it didn't faze him that the boyfriend had stepped in. In fact, he thought very quickly on his feet and turned it into something else to confuse the boyfriend and make it sound like it was some kind of revenge or grudge. So that told me this was somebody who was potentially criminally sophisticated. He knew what he was doing, and therefore this guy was going to be a big problem. And I went back to London and I searched for offences, and actually I did find an offence. And you will know that when you're breaking down an offence, it's very detailed, nuanced work. And I'll share with everybody some of the categories of my headings of what I look for when I'm analysing a case. Similar fact, bad character, but more importantly, actually, it's called comparative case analysis, where you're looking at the micro detail. So comparative case analysis is very important when you're linking cases. And this really was what became my expertise, at being able to get into the micro detail. And I did find an offence on the same night in London, the same night in St John's Wood. And that was North London, where a woman was walking home from work, and it was 4:25 a.m. when she had seen a guy sat on a bench that she felt uneasy about. And she carried on walking. She then felt so uneasy, she looked behind her again. She felt she was being followed. So here's the thing that I see with a lot of rape statements, is that a victim may intuit danger before the offence. And that's why I always say, trust your gut, trust your instinct. The minute you have that, pay attention to it. She did pay attention, but then she carried on walking. She heard footsteps and she was grabbed from behind. And he immediately said, there are two things you don't want to do. And this has stayed with me my whole career, what he said to her. There are two things you don't want to do. The first is scream or shout. The second is run. Do you understand? I'll hurt you. I could break your neck. Do you understand? Okay, this was an offender who knew how to control a victim through a surprise attack immediately. There was no physical punching in the face. It was through his threats and him grabbing round the throat and squeezing the windpipe, telling the victim of his intent. And this is why I take exception when I hear an officer say, but did you scream? Did you scream? I see that still in a lot of cases. She said specifically in her statement, because I had it pulled immediately, that she didn't scream. She believed him, that he meant what he said.
Because he says it with such conviction, doesn't he? He says it with such conviction.
Absolutely. And he kept saying, you know, do you understand? And he initially said he was after money. How much money do you have? And this, again, is a compliance test to see whether this victim is malleable or not. And then he kept saying, I'm not going to rape you. Okay, the minute you hear that, you know that's what's going to happen. So this is sort of prevention advice I'm giving to victims now, or to women. Never go to a secondary location, and you are the best judge of what's going on in that situation, whether you fight it, whether you comply. This particular victim complied the whole time because she felt this threat was very real. And she did everything that he said. He was very complimentary to her in the end. And he asked a lot of intimate questions about her. He actually spent an hour and 30 minutes with her, which is a significant amount of time, isn't it, Sam?
It is significant, isn't it? Absolutely.
So this gave me a lot of behaviour, a lot of language. He basically said to her that he had wife problems, that he had had a baby, that things weren't going well. He said that He had credit card issues. He went into the whole poor me syndrome of what I would call now poor me syndrome. He talked about women leading men on, and it's the woman's fault when these things happen. He talked about prison not being a deterrent, which told me he had most likely been in prison before. He talked about other offences he had done that night. So thinking about what happened in Essex, yeah, and again, this is just another nod to, you can be in Essex one night in Southend, and then you can be in London within the hour.
Yeah.
And you know that, I know that, but oftentimes we come up against that whole, well, this is Surrey, and this job's in London, therefore it can't be linked, right? And that's really frustrating when we hear that.
I'll pick up on the whole history of linking offences and where we were at that time and just how difficult it was. I'll give a mini history lesson on that in due course. But yeah, very, very difficult to link offences, and across different force areas, exceptionally difficult.
Absolutely. But with this particular case in North London, in St John's Wood, there was just so much behaviour, and the victim did everything right. I just want to make that clear in terms of her complying with everything that he said. She even feigned having an orgasm because he demanded that she should have an orgasm.
Did she enjoy it? Yeah.
Yeah. And therefore, it was my belief, he believed this was a consensual encounter, particularly because at the end, he started giving her advice about keeping herself safe and not being out at 4 in the morning. And he complimented her the whole way through, saying she was absolutely gorgeous. She was married. She had a little one, a child. And she told him about that. And he gave her all this advice and very complimentary. And he even patted her on the bottom on the way of him leaving her and her leaving and saying, take the bus next time, patted her on the bottom as if they were in a relationship. So he was, in my opinion, an intimacy seeker.
Yes.
And I'll come on to that in a bit more detail, but the offence was horrific. She managed to get home. She debated whether she should tell her husband. And in the end, she did, because she was worried about other women. And that was really her driving force behind reporting it. And I'm so glad that she did. And I just want to say, reporting is a very big step. You know that. I know that. But thank goodness she did, because actually this offence for me was absolutely critical in being able to link other offences. And what then happened was flagging this particular offence, ensuring that we did the forensics, led to us getting a DNA profile, which came later on. So we knew that this particular offence was linked to what we then found out, to the Southend 3 o'clock in the morning attack on Monday, the 31st of August. And then it also DNA linked with the other Southender attack just a few hours before. So we had the DNA come in, and it linked the series. So that was important. It wasn't just on behaviour. We didn't have DNA in the bungled attack. So that was always my belief that it was linked, but we didn't have forensics that confirmed that. What we then had was the Sussex case coming in as being DNA linked as well. So I don't know whether you want to say something about that now, Sam, and then I'll say, once we knew that we had an offence in Brighton, I then ended up analysing that, looking for other similar offences elsewhere. But this was really the launch of Monarch, it becoming a linked investigative series, and us meeting and trying to pool our knowledge, our resources, and work together to produce the best outcome possible to ensure that we identified this man who was very prolific, who was also travelling. So we had Essex, London, Sussex. We knew he was prolific. We knew he was travelling. We knew there would be more historically, but we knew there'd be more future. And that was our concern right from the start, that we need to protect future women, but we also need to make sure we find the other previous offences he had committed. But the Brighton offence was a very significant one. It happened on Saturday, the 29th of August. It was an 11:30 p.m. attack. And again, very important to link these cases.
Yeah, so this case, I don't have any of my notes from the time. So, but I know obviously you prepared all of the court evidence and everything else, because you were nominated as the lead analyst, which we'll also come on to later on. But so I was working in the Force Intelligence Bureau at the time in Sussex, and it was our job there, because there wasn't a standalone major crime team at that point that would deal with any serious sexual offences or murders. That came in much later on. But so it'd be the Force Intelligence Bureau's job to take anything serious. And every morning you get to work and you'd look through the logs as to what had come in overnight. Well, you know, it's a standard thing that you do. You have a look. And lo and behold, on a Monday morning, and on the Saturday, the 29th of August, there'd been a rape of an 18-year-old girl who was coming back from a night out in Brighton. Between 11:30 and 12 at night, she was in the Sutherland Road area of Brighton, and walking back to get back home, she'd got off the bus, I believe. A young man comes up to the side of her, starts chatting to her. I think she obviously thinks, I'm just going to get home. I don't know. You don't know why you're chatting to me. And then he suddenly grabs her by the throat and pushes it. So he obviously sees his opportunity to push her down an alleyway between two houses. So he takes her by the throat. The same language used, don't scream. If you scream, I'll kill you. But obviously we didn't know it was the same language at that point. So for me, I was looking at a standalone offence. Takes her down the alleyway where obviously the same control was being used and a horrific rape takes place, to the point where she was compliant, and quite rightly so, but she can hear a dog walker walking past the top of the alleyway. So help was within reaching distance, and she was so scared that, you know, she didn't scream out because of that same issue that she believed that he was going to inflict her serious harm. The same pattern of behaviour that he talks to her, you know, he's trying to be intimate with her. He's asking about boyfriends. Somewhere in my mind, I've got a memory of him asking if he could be her boyfriend. I remember reading the initial account and then looking at this statement and thinking, this is bad news. This is bad news. This is real predatory. You know, and the same thing as you, anyone that comes and overpowers by grabbing around the throat, I knew immediately that we had an issue. And I thought we were going to have an issue just in the Brighton area. But just to set the scene of how difficult linking offences was back there. So back in 1998, forces very much sort of looked after their own area. And the only way, Laura, I'm sure you're going to remember this, was so every Friday there used to be a paper, everyone take note of this, a paper publication called the National Police Gazette. That used to come out. And if you wanted a case, if you wanted attention drawn to a case so that other forces would see it at that time, you used to have to put an article in the National Police Gazette. So this is at a time before there was any kind of link system other than the police national computer. But we're talking about systems that could, you know, flag up any kind of linking of offences. What had started, obviously, because that's where I started my career, was the serious crime, the National Crime Faculty and the Serious Crime Analysis Section. And the whole reason that unit was set up was as an outcome of the Byford Report.
Yes.
And the Byford Report was a big report into all the activity that took place in Yorkshire, PS. We're not going to name him.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Everyone knows what that is. You know what we're talking about.
Listen to the Forgotten Victims series where I dissect it and speak to some of the people involved in the case. And Sam's using the initials of the offender because actually he's not really important.
Really not. Really not. But the whole issue in relation to that were two forces that weren't talking to one another. Well, my goodness, that wasn't the whole issue. That was a minor issue, but that was certainly preventing the detection of the cases. So a big government report was drawn as to where the failings had come in there, and the Byford Report was written. And one of the outcomes of the Byford Report was the National Crime Faculty being set up with the Serious Crime Analysis Section.
Not to mention the huge amounts of misogyny and sexism and attitudes that the victims weren't worthy enough to actually do anything. And I say that, I know that you know that, but that is not really included in the report. So yes, NCOF came out of that, and my satellite unit in New Scotland Yard, the sexual offences section, was also meant to be the answer, right, to joining up cases and having a database to index these offences. Because actually, Sam, in the sexual offences section, in the intelligence branch, our linkage system, well, it was Spectrums. We had a piece of paper for specialist crimes that someone filled out each morning, the crimes overnight, and I would go through them with Jackie and we would index them and we would say, oh, hang on a minute, we had something in three area about 2 years ago. That sounds quite similar. And then we'd pull the statements, we'd look at the crime report, we'd speak to the investigating officers. So that was linkage analysis until we started to create a specialist database.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's really important to kind of set the history and background of what we were up against. Because,
yes.
You know, when I've been revisiting these cases, I'm just thinking, this is amazing. This is amazing that we got on top of things as quickly as we did. But the reason that happened is because in each of the force areas, there became a dedicated contact person. So forces did start to speak to each other through, and those contact people tended to be analysts. Is it Operation Catchment? I'm fairly sure that was the... Was it Operation Catchment?
Yes, that predated Monarch.
Yes. Was to look for and start to try and flag up any potentially linked series. I mean, and since those days, everything has become a lot more sophisticated and, you know, forces can talk to each other on a better level. But it was really, I want to say archaic. It was an archaic way of dealing with crime, but... through talking to people and talking to other analysts, we did manage to link series. And the Sussex job is a really good example of that, because within a few days, I'd spoken to one of the Essex analysts, I think it was, and said, God, I've had an absolutely awful, dreadful offence that's happened in Brighton. And when we start talking, it's like, oh, that's what the offender in our link series has said. And yeah, obviously at that point, I kind of said, right, I'm going to get off the phone now. We need to escalate this. So the Sussex one was brought into part of the Essex one, is my memory serving me? Feel free to correct me. It's 20 plus years ago.
Yes. Well, I know that the forensics were fast-tracked, and that's the other important part, that when I got involved at SO11, I worked with a brilliant FSS, Forensic Science Service, intelligence officer called Mary Newton. And I would pick up the phone to Mary and say, this case, and this case. And Mary would scratch her head. She'd tell me what's doable, what's not, and she would make it happen. She was just incredible. And then there was Ray Fyshe, who came along once the series was linked. He would then come in as sort of the coordinator of forensics. But the first part is, like you said, phone a friend. So whether it's your intelligence analyst, you know, of knowing each other force to force, or for me, Mary Newton was just incredible at what she did. And you build that good relationship, right? And then you start to get shit done. And so the Brighton offence, one thing, I'm looking at the court report now, one thing that was really key was the language. And what he said, first of all, was, did you see Jason? Do you know Jason? If you see him, don't tell him you saw me, because I've got a problem with the kiddie. It's not Jason I want, it's you. There's no such person as Jason. It's just a name I use. Walk down here. Then he pushed her down the alley. So the language, we had Jason in two offences, and this actually, he approached her first of all, and it was more of a confidence approach, which told us, you know, that he was able to do that, to engage someone in conversation, to allay their fears, and then to attack them. But what he also said was, if you run, I'll catch you. You have high heels on and you'll never make it, and I'll kill you. If you scream again, I'll kill you. Just shut up, listen to me. And then he said what he was going to do to her. And he said, you're the youngest person I've done this to. There are 15 other girls in this area. All I have to do is hit you. And he knocked on her head and said, and then you'll be unconscious. Now, he said that in multiple other offences. If I do this to you, you'll be unconscious. Then I can do whatever I want to you. He tapped into women's fears, the biggest fears that you might have. And then he gave them if-then scenarios. But he also wanted them to be participants in the abuse, that he saw it, in my view, as a consensual encounter, which is important because linking that across offences, but also what he said at court when he kept saying it wasn't rape and he refused to acknowledge it was rape. And he actually said to some of the victims that rape is when you're battered black and blue. This isn't rape. So it also is a way of distancing for offenders, for them to rationalize and minimize what they've done and chalk it up to a consensual encounter, where all the way through the attack in Brighton, he threatened her continuously and constantly. And she was terrified, Sam. I still remember reading the statement, us talking about it and understanding her fear was just palpable. And then he sort of notches it up as, you know, that this is a consensual encounter. really terrifying.
And do you know what? You reading those words, I've literally gone cold, because I can, it's almost like you've taken me back and put me back in, you know, sat at my desk looking out the window at the false intelligence and reading that statement for the first time and thinking, we have got a real problem here. As you know, and as an analyst, you get a sense from those, you know, from when you read a statement, you do get a sense of things are dreadfully, I was going to say dreadfully serious, but that's the wrong thing to say because it all is. But you just get that innate sense, I think.
Yes, and that he was very prolific. But what I was fearful of was just how criminally sophisticated he was. He was always conscious of them not looking at him. He always gave these if-then scenarios. He had thought it all through. He knew exactly what would run through someone's mind if they were grabbed, in my opinion, because he had done this so many times before. And then he would give these if-then scenarios all the time saying, this isn't rape. This isn't rape. And he would continuously say that. And that's why I still believe we've got many other offences still potentially out there. But the Brighton offence was just so similar to the Essex offences and to the London one in St John's Wood. So we knew that we had four DNA-linked offences. That came later after you and I had spoken about it. Essex, we had linked them and we'd all agreed that this was the same offender. And it was later on that the DNA came back, which supported what we were saying. So we had four offences linked through forensics. At that stage, one on MO, modus operandi, which is what we would look at. And oftentimes the MO on a crime report might be three sentences. Do you remember that? It'd be like three sentences of like an hour and a half attack.
Infuriating, yes.
Yeah. And that was always the challenge for us. And then you would ask for the statement. So, I mean, this was before they were linked. I was already looking for other offences. So I would break down each of the offences and I was asked by, well, there was an OIC put in charge, wasn't there? An officer in overall command, which ended up being Paddy Tompkins because he was the London commander. And when I looked in London, I found there were actually 12 offences that I believe strongly were the same perpetrator. Of course, we didn't know who it was. And in fact, six of those ended up being Mary Newton. Hi, Mary, it's Laura. Could you please look at the forensic opportunities here? I see there's X, Y, and Z available. Can you ensure that they are fast-tracked? And Mary would give her two pennies worth and did the work with Ray Fyshe to ensure that it was fast-tracked. Then we have the sort of the scrum down of who's the oik and who's the doik, which always made me laugh.
Always made me laugh.
The officer in overall command, Paddy Tompkins, the commander, and we had a meeting at Cannon Row. The doik was Lee Weavers from Essex. He was their commander crime, wasn't he? And Dave Bright was working to him. My job was very much, you know, could you please look at each offence, look at potentially what else other forces should be analysing. So it's not just looking for more in London, more in Essex, more in Sussex. It was them putting out a good old fashioned bulletin asking all forces to look at specific offences. And I would lay out the comparative case analysis key points, and then all forces would look to see what they had. And then they would, the information audit trail would come back to me. And as I always said, MG11s permitting, MG11s were statements, victim statements. I would create a behavioral profile in order to undertake other searches for London, pan London. And you need to know the offender profile to do that, the type of offences you're looking for. And it really is at times the needle in the haystack. But what I would always come up against was the statements not being good enough and officers having to go back, revisit the victims. And I really didn't like that process where they had to go back and ask more questions, which is why and how I ended up training what were the detectives up at Hendon Detective Training School. I used to go up there, train the detectives, but also then what came to be known as SOITs, the Sexual Offences Investigative Teams. They were chaperones originally. What a terrible name, because they did so much more than that. And actually, my dissertation for my first psychology degree was on the role of chaperones and just how overworked and undervalued they were. And my work was used to actually bolster that role when they became SOITs. So I had a very keen interest in professionalizing the importance, you know, of what they did and ensuring that victims got the best care at their worst time. And that's really where the Sowits came from. So breaking down the offences, because like I said, I found many others in London. I just want to share with people the methodology, because this is something I was fortunate enough to be mentored on and trained on early on in my career. We were a satellite. We were very much based on the behavioral analysis units at the FBI. But I had some great mentors, Jackie being one of them. And just to give you some idea of the headings of what I would look to. So, you know, if we take the North London case where she unfortunately had to endure an hour and 30 minutes of being attacked and just all the things that he said to her. I broke, first of all, the case down into case detail. So the date, time, location, and what the victim was doing prior to the offence. What I was looking for with that is the possibility of stalking, because we know now our language is these are predatory stalkers that we're talking about.
They are.
But we didn't really use that language back then, Sam, did we?
We really didn't. Predatory, yes, but no, but thinking a bit in terms of stalking, no, definitely not. But looking, you know, looking at all of the actions that a victim takes before the, you know, the first contact, the initial contact is so important.
Really is. So I was trying to figure out, did he stalk them, find them? Then it took some time before he actually attacked them. And actually, I did see some very interesting things when I was looking at that. But of course, I had to keep going back to say, well, we don't know that. Where was the victim before? So for us, that's important to know. Victims' details, their name, their ethnicity, their age, their occupation, the approach method. You know, what was the victim doing when approached? When did they first become aware of the offender? And what I will say is that most of the victims heard footsteps or sensed something prior to the grab. And that, again, is why my trust your instincts is important. Don't give two hoots about upsetting someone or offending someone. If you have that gut instinct, the hairs on the back of your neck go up, or you're looking round because you sense something from that perpetrator, pay attention to it. Yeah. And I would look at the confidence approach, the surprise approach, the blitz approach, and plus the details of that. And I learned quite quickly that this individual used a mixture of methods. He would surprise attack, but he'd also, in some of them, talk to the victim prior and test compliance before and then attack. So, but he wasn't going up to them punching them in the face. And we'll talk about a case where that happened.
We will.
So the method of control, what I lay out is looking to how did he control them? Was there a weapon? Was there physical and verbal demands made? And there was a real intensity of this offender around controlling the victim very early on, giving the if-then scenarios of whatever their biggest fear was. He was already checking that off and telling them that right from the start.
Yeah.
Then I'd look at the precautions that the offender took to ensure his personal safety, because that would tell me about criminal sophistication, being forensically aware, i.e. they've done this before, they're prolific, they may well be in the system already. And this guy was always about ensuring his personal safety, i.e. not being identified, and took many measures to try and ensure that that didn't happen. In terms of sighting, the victim seeing the perpetrator, putting things over their heads, forcing them, telling them constantly to shut their eyes.
Keep their eyes shut, yeah. Yeah, I remember that well.
Yeah. Then I look at theft. Was there any theft? And oftentimes he would go in with that ruse. I just want your money. I'm not going to rape you. So as I've said, when you hear that, but he would use that ruse of I'm after money. Violence was another heading that I would look to. You know, and again, that talks to control. But some offenders are very sadistic. They go in with a punch immediately, and it's not just about control. It can be about being sadistic and enjoying doing that, punishing the victim.
I think when you say violence, it's important that people understand the level of detail that we would then break that down to. It's not just was violence used, tick. You know, it's like the type of violence and where on the body and, you know, how long and how forceful and... It all plays into this very detailed picture, particularly with, you know, comparative case analysis, when you're looking at that absolute minute detail.
Absolutely. The levels of control talk to violence, verbal, physical threats. And so the nuance detail, absolutely critical. The fact that when he threatened with the North London victim, when he first grabbed her, threatened to break her neck, but he also tightened his grip around the victim's neck to exert pain and pressure. The pressure was a reminder, I have control over your life. I have utter control of you. And then him threatening to punch her in the face if she attempted to bite his penis. You know, he would put in other reinforcers. He raised his fist to her head and tapped on her head. Like, I'm not just talking about, like, knocking. He physically hit her head and said, I can knock you unconscious and then I can do whatever I want to you. And that was a recurring theme. I would also look at, this is another heading, victims' coping and defense strategies and the offender's response, because that, how the victim reacts can often then impact how the perpetrator behaves. So again, we have to take that into account. I've worked series where in one attack, a horrific rape, he didn't physically punch her in the face. In the next attack, at a similar location, he punched her so badly in the face, she had to have facial reconstruction surgery. It was absolutely horrific what he did to her. And the investigating officer kept saying to me, but they can't be linked, Laura, because look, he's physically violent in this one, but not in this one. I said, that's not how we link offences. We have to think about the detail and how she responds and how he responds. The second attack, she was non-compliant. She fought for her life. He then taught her a lesson to gain control over her. So again, it's looking at how the perpetrator responds, and it tells us much more about them. And it really is that nuanced detail. And looking across, my next heading is offenders' mood and demeanor and changes and what appeared to provoke them. I'm jumping in here to wrap part one of our discussion about Operation Monarch. You can probably understand just how granular my behavioral analysis work is, and indeed the work of crime analysts. It's nuanced, detailed, and skilled work, particularly when analysing sexual offences and rape and a potentially linked series. And there really is no substitute for experience. You can't learn this from reading a book, and it's never really accurately portrayed in crime documentaries or scripted shows. So you're probably hearing it really here for the first time on Crime Analyst, and I hope you found our conversation interesting and illuminating. Next time, we get into much more detail about the analysis, the offences, how Richard Baker was caught, what happened at the trial, and also what's the latest with the case. Because it didn't end there when this prolific serial rapist went to prison. Until next time, be curious, ask questions, and always trust your instinct. Here's my final thought and ask before the episode wraps. I really appreciate you listening to Crime Analyst, and if you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen to me. It really helps others find me and my work, and it helps with the ratings too. Crime Analyst is written, produced, and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Jason Sheasley at Abridged Audio. Cover art and graphics by Chris Robottom at Syndicate, and music by Kilrude.